This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. Trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful?
I just don't know what to think about it right now. Used to see other boys fish in the backyard in their boat and go over and talk about gardening and stuff like that. Nothing political, nothing religious.
They are apparently nothing like Boy Scouts down in North Carolina, as a 14-page indictment describes a homegrown group of jihadists traveling, recruiting, terrorist merit badges, or global threats. It's a question on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to lead off with that alleged terrorism story this morning. It's Wednesday, July 29th. I'm John Hockenberry. Amy Holmes is with us all week. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
Your old boss, Senator Bill Frist, is going to be with us today. You weren't his surgical nurse. You were a speechwriter, right?
I was a speechwriter, yeah. And no knives.
That's right, indeed. On The Takeaway this hour, we're going to be talking about a lot of sports stories. Brett Favre is going to stay in retirement. Michael Phelps has a swimsuit controversy. We're going to find about it. It has nothing to do with fashions, I'm telling you. And also, steak. You're finding it in places you never thought before. And it's an economic story. But first, joining us from North Carolina, Dave DeWitt, Raleigh Bureau Chief, reporter from North Carolina Public Radio. So which is it, Dave? North Carolinians are waking up to a pretty shocking story this morning that's been brewing for a little while. Is this merit badges? Is it Boy Scouts? Or is it a real threat that they're looking at?
It's a real threat. I don't think anybody's laying it out as being something that's not a real threat. People are concerned if any of the allegations are true, which are in the 14-page indictment you mentioned, then people are really concerned. They're also very confused and curious at this point. They're not sure what to think and whom to believe, but people are taking it very seriously.
Well, we'll go over all the details with you in just a moment, but first, everything you need to know this morning. In the headlines, top breaking news, Defense Secretary Robert Gates, on his way home from a trip to Iraq, says there is a chance of, get this, a modest acceleration in the pace of U.S. troop withdrawals there. His top general in Iraq says the security situation on the ground is better than expected. Other breaking news, Microsoft has just announced a deal, finally, after months and months of negotiations. It was on, it was off, it was on, it was off. Microsoft has a deal with Yahoo for an internet search partnership. Google, beware. This ends years of back-and-forth negotiations. Amy?
As we've been reporting this morning, the president hits the road again to sell his health care proposals. Today, he'll be in North Carolina and Virginia, two swing states, if you remember. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has signed his revised state budget after slashing billions from the plan with his line-item veto. State Democrats are criticizing him for cutting social welfare programs.
Page one story on our part of the New York Times, prison abuse following Iran's post-election crackdown on opposition figures. Iran is apparently trying to deflect criticism. This week, the government released 140 prisoners and ordered one prison closed. Markets mostly flat yesterday. The Dow opens next hour at 90.97. The S&P starts trading at 980, still slowly moving up towards 1,000 there. And the NASDAQ begins at 1976, although futures trading suggests it's going to be a negative opening. We're talking health care today. We want to get your advice. What can Obama do to get health care passed? Or should it just die?
Hi, I'm Howard Bigel from Salem, New Hampshire. Don't have the legislator telling each insurance company what they can cover. Just have a public plan that covers what the legislators think they need to cover.
Obama isn't the only one who can have a town meeting. You can join ours here at The Takeaway at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
This is Amy Holmes in All Week here with John Hockenberry. So, John, I'm sure you saw the shocking headlines out of North Carolina. Daniel Boyd, 39 years old, drywall installer,
yeah,
former football player, son of a Marine, and it looks like he might be guilty of terror charges.
Well, let's continue now with Dave DeWitt, Raleigh Bureau Chief, reporter for North Carolina Public Radio. Review the bidding a little bit. 14-page indictment. We've already talked about that. Seven people arrested. This group is alleged to have amassed a sophisticated arsenal, practices military tactics in rural North Carolina, and has traveled to Gaza, Israel, Jordan, and Kosovo. What are people in the community around where these arrests took place, Dave, thinking this morning?
Well, it's still pretty new. You know, these things all came out Monday. Was sort of a raid on these seven individuals, all in different parts of town. And people are now just starting to sort of get the facts together. You know, you do see some of the jumping to conclusions, and unfortunately, to sort of take the Muslim community here in Raleigh and put them all in the same boat. And that's the Muslim community here is very active. It's about 6,000 strong in the Raleigh area. And they've gotten out in front of this and said, look, you know, we don't know what the situation is here. We know these people. We don't know them well. You know, please don't paint us all with the same brush. We're all different folks.
Let's listen to Jihad Shawa of the Muslim American Society Freedom Raleigh chapter speaking at a news conference there in North Carolina, expressing some of those sentiments you just referred to.
There are 60,000 Muslims in North Carolina. Let's just look at it from a good point of view that few people, whether they are innocent or guilty, that doesn't mean it has to hit the Muslims community here and Islam too.
But Dave DeWitt, as a North Carolina Public Radio reporter, there are Muslim connections in this indictment among the people who were arrested. Could you outline those for us?
Yeah. You know, the ringleader is supposedly Daniel Boyd. He's 39 years old, and he's got a very interesting history we can talk about in a little bit. But the other men are all pretty much younger. And so the allegations are that Daniel Boyd was the ringleader and that these younger men had become disenchanted in their own lives and somewhat disenchanted with the Muslim faith as it's practiced in some of the more moderate mosques here in Raleigh, and that they had formed this group. And Daniel Boyd and his family, two of the arrested people are sons of his, broke from the Islamic Center here in Raleigh about a year ago and started having prayer services at his house. And so this group formed, and the wife of Daniel Boyd now has come out, Sabrina Boyd, and she says, well, these trips they took overseas, these things, they were just to get in touch with their Islamic faith and to go on some trips and understand what countries that are predominantly Islam and how they work. Obviously, the U.S. government sees it a little bit differently. They've got some evidence. They haven't really laid out much of it,
right.
Some of it in the indictment. So,
and there's apparently one suspect we don't know that possibly is still at large. Dave,
right.
You know, as I'm looking at these details here, and, you know, maybe I'm totally out of line here, but it seems as though the Boyd family has adopted a curious amalgam of North Carolina kind of camping mentality, military mentality, and then thrown in this sort of Muslim element here. It's a curiously familiar and unfamiliar mix.
Yeah, North Carolina is an interesting place for a lot of reasons, but one of those is, you know, this is a state with a very strong military background. You know, Fort Bragg, Camp Lejeune are here. It's a very rural area. The places where Daniel Boyd lives is a county that's very rural near Raleigh, Johnston County, and they supposedly did some training exercises in a different part of the county. Or a different part of the state, pardon me, Caswell County. And, of course, the international headquarters for Blackwater is also here in North Carolina.
Interesting
stuff.
So
you see a state that's very militaristic, very pro-gun, but you also have a very strong sort of other side, if you will, a sort of a liberal bent to certain metropolitan areas. So
sure.
it's a state that's changing a lot, and many people that I've talked to in the federal government, the FBI, said, in a way, it's a breeding ground for some of these kinds of activities because of that sort of pro-military background.
Well, more details from the federal authorities as well as more reaction from North Carolina will be following it. Dave DeWitt, Raleigh Bureau Chief and reporter for North Carolina Public Radio. Fantastic. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
So let's take a step back, John, and look at how Daniel Boyd fits into the bigger picture of international terrorism. With us is Peter Bergen, fellow at the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C., and author of Holy War, Inc., Inside the Secret World of Bin Laden. Peter, thank you for joining us.
Morning, Amy.
So, Peter, you tend to be generally skeptical of these homegrown terror cases, but you think this case is different. Can you explain?
Well, a lot of the cases that we've seen over the last several years since 9/11 have been informant-driven. So there's always the question of, is somebody being entrapped? Often the cases have revolved around people talking about acts of terrorism, not really doing anything. But we've seen a number of cases in the last year or so where, you know, I think the bar is higher. The cases in Minnesota, for instance, of the group of Somali Americans who went to fight with a sort of quasi Al Qaeda like group in Somalia. One of the Americans involved actually committed suicide in a suicide attack, the first time ever an American has done that. A case recently in Arkansas, in Little Rock, where a African-American convert to Islam traveled to Yemen, seemed to get more radicalized there, and then shot up and killed an American soldier at an Army recruiting station in Little Rock, Arkansas. And the recent case in Long Island, where a guy from Long Island goes out to Pakistan, joins an Al-Qaeda training camp in 2008, volunteers for a suicide mission, actually partakes in a operation against an American base in Afghanistan. And now this case. Now this case doesn't quite amount to those others yet from what we know about it, but one of the unindicted, one of the conspirators whose name has been redacted in the indictment traveled to Pakistan recently, apparently, for training. This group had assembled a very large number of weapons. Now that might be pretty routine for North Carolina, as you sort of already indicated, John, but when you combine that with the kinds of views about jihad and martyrdom that appear in the indictment, and then you combine that with travel to places like Kosovo and Jordan and Israel, which may be routine tourist trips, as the wife of the main conspirator suggests, or it may be because they were seeking some form of jihad opportunity, as the Department of Justice suggests.
Right.
That will. Go ahead.
Sure. Peter, let's get into that. I'm sure a lot of people are asking, how does the boy next door end up with terrorists in his Rolodex? I mean, what connects someone from North Carolina to a shadowy group in Pakistan?
Well, you know, I think in this case it was a cell leader. Daniel Boyd was 20 years older than most of the conspirators, more or less. He'd actually fought in the jihad against the Soviets in Afghanistan with a group called Hezbi Islami, which is run by a guy called Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, at that time a major recipient of U.S. aid. But now...
yeah, as you've reported, Peter, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar has received more than $1 billion of U.S. aid over the last 20, 30 years.
In the 80s, his group received at least $600 million, if you take the most conservative estimates. So... You know, this guy now, of course, is a close ally of the Taliban. He's fighting American and NATO soldiers in Afghanistan. He is a longtime ally of Osama bin Laden's. So Daniel Boyd, the ringleader of this group, fought with that group. It's a fairly radical group, and obviously he would have received a fair amount of training and also battlefield experience.
Wow.
So I think the point that John is making, too, though, is that are we seeing still the reverberations, the blowback from the conflict in Afghanistan?
Yeah, we are. But, there's a sort of conspiracists and leftists would sort of say, well, you know, the World Trade Center attack was blowback from an operation gone awry in Afghanistan. I think that's a leap. The CIA didn't fund or train people like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar or Daniel Boyd. The money went through the Pakistanis,
right,
who unfortunately made their own choices about where the money went.
Well, the two takeaways here I hear, Peter, and I think Amy's gotten to it as well, is number one, do the feds have evidence that the Pakistanis or active terrorist groups in the region, in the Middle East, actually thought these guys had credibility and might have signed them up for something? That's like takeaway number one. Takeaway number two is maybe even more disturbing. Is there an emerging pattern in the United States of homegrown, home passionately sort of motivated jihadists that we're going to be seeing popping up everywhere from North Carolina to Minnesota, right?
Well, there is a sort of mini wavelet right now. Does it make a constellation? I'm not sure. Does it make something of a pattern? Perhaps. And certainly because American Muslims tend to be better educated than most Americans on average, better, have higher incomes, tend not to be living in ghettos, very different situation than what you see in Europe. I mean, I and many others have thought that the United States would be somewhat insulated from this phenomenon. But when you have several cases like these all popping up in the same year, you have to ask yourself the question, is that really the case? I mean, is there a possibility of a homegrown radical movement in the United States? And these four cases we've discussed, may amount to something more than just isolated incidents.
Thank you, Peter. It's scary stuff. Thank you for joining us this morning. You were listening to Peter Bergen, fellow at the New America Foundation, Washington, D.C., and author of Holy War, Inc., Inside the Secret World of Bin Laden. Well,
it's not just people in North Carolina that are asking those questions this morning. That's what we're all asking.
Indeed.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Amy Holmes, and this week with John Hockenberry. John, the swimming world was hit by a tidal wave yesterday.
Not only is he going to beat Phelps, he's going to smash his world record. Paul Biedermann of Germany, 142 flat. Phelps in a very rare silver medal performance.
Not only did Olympic great Michael Phelps lose yesterday in a major individual event for the first time in 4 years.
Poor guy.
4 years, right? Paul Biedermann of Germany smashed Phelps' record by almost a whole second, which you and I know is like an eon in swimming.
That's huge. But this actually isn't an athletic story at all. It's not a swimming story. It's a fashion story.
Ooh,
it's
about, I like fashion
performance
stories.
Performance-enhancing fashions. Biedermann of Germany was wearing a swimsuit that may be banned in international sports next year, a high-tech plastic suit. And Phelps doesn't wear that suit. It could be the margin and the difference in this particular week. Will Phelps get his record back? Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is here in the studio to explain. He's our own Takeaway Sports contributor. Ibrahim, Michael Phelps lost.
Well, it's kind of like you want swimming to be like car racing. You have a great pit team. You have, that has the best suit, and they suit you up, and they send you out there, and then you swim the fastest time. So I think it's a step below performance-enhancing drugs.
But let's back away for a minute. I mean, the technology in the swimsuits, and nice Speedos you're wearing there, Ibrahim, the technology in competitive swimming has really gone off the radar since China, really.
Correct. The FINA, the governing body for the sport, has said that they want to ban all they want to ban metallic-based fibers in the suits. So you would only have you wouldn't have the ability to have like an alloy on the top of your suit. Which
is that
makes
what
it
makes
super fast.
Makes them go super fast?
Correct. Yeah. So that's one of the things that makes them go fast. The design, the way it's cut. They want to make it look like a shark.
I see.
So that's how you're supposed to move through the water with some rough spots and some smooth spots.
So why doesn't Phelps just put on one of these suits and, you know, get his record
right
back?
Why didn't he get one? They didn't have one in his size?
Well, this is the funny part. This is when you have – it's kind of like Phelps' team crying wolf after he's fleeced the flock. He's contractually obligated to Speedo for last year's super-duper suit.
Oh, you know, so that's not swimming anymore. It's NASCAR.
NASCAR.
Swimming has become NASCAR. Well, not to spend all of our time on swimming, much as we love you and your Speedos here, let's talk about Brett Favre. The other big story this morning is quarterback Brett Favre, in and out of retirement, is going to stay in retirement. What do you think that decision was all about? Because he was thinking of going to the Vikings, right?
Well, yeah, the Vikings were definitely interested in having him. I think that Brett Favre spent a considerable amount of this year working out with a high school squad to get ready. News to Brett Favre, you can go, there's life after football in the NFL. You can go be a coach to that high school team. His shoulder just wasn't ready. His shoulder failed him last year with the Jets. He tried to push it. He tried to come back. He tried to get surgery. It just didn't work out.
Were fans clamoring for his return to football?
The Vikings kind of were.
I think I think there were some people that definitely see the value of, you know, you get a guy like Brett Favre in your squad, he's going to deliver. Versus a younger quarterback, they may not have that kind of experience. So if his arm was ready, then I bet the Vikings fans would have been super ready.
It was a strange story because Favre had been stomping on the Vikings from Green Bay for years and years and years. And for the Vikings to want him, it was odd to me to see them in Favre T-shirts. And you would see him at Twins games in Brett Favre T-shirts. So Michael Vick, that's the other big NFL story. We talked about it earlier this week. Vick out of prison. Goodell says at the NFL, the head of the NFL says he can practice, maybe not play. Tony Dungy is mentoring him. How does that work?
That's going to be an interesting question to see how it comes plays out. And first of all, someone has to want Vic, and we've heard that the Jacksonville Jaguars have been interested, but they've also pulled back on their interest. No one has stepped forward and say we want him. So I think in the meantime, Vic is going to be a liability because he's definitely going to miss some games. So teams have to decide whether they are going to be comfortable with him missing games. And I think Dungy is going to be a good force, like almost like a wizard-like force for good in his camp.
But what about the fans? Do you think people will turn out to the stadium just to see Michael Vick return to football?
Definitely. I think without a doubt. There's also going to be protesters that are going to come out to the stadiums just to protest Michael Vick coming back to football.
I mean,
but without a question, you're going to have guys there.
The signs in the stands, the
t-shirts. Oh, I hate to imagine that.
I mean, it's really – well, they're very creative there, NFL fans, that's for sure. Is this Kabuki Theater, though, is it totally clear that Vick is coming back? He will be a major quarterback, if not this season, then next?
The question is, will he be ready to play at that high level? He's been out of football for 23 months while he was in prison. Before that, he was out of football for a considerable amount of time. He's 31, 32 years old. We're not sure if he's going to have those NFL legs. However, he might be fresher because he's had all that time away. Michael Vick will make an impact with whoever he plays with.
Finally, I mean, it just sort of brings us straight to another controversial player in the NFL. Plaxico Burress faces a weapons charge for shooting himself in the thigh. Certainly one of my favorite stories of 2008. He's going to testify before a Manhattan grand jury at 10 a.m. today. Does Plaxico Burress have a future in the NFL?
Plaxico Burress probably did the worst thing in the city where that you just can't do that. We just heard yesterday New York City was going crazy about not getting federal funding for police. New York, and how they got that reputation of being a big city with low crime is that they cracked down on firearms. A guy like Plaxico Burress to walk into a bar with a gun in his sweatpants.
Even if he is a Giants wide receiver.
I think that even will make him much more of an example, and I think they're going to throw the book at him.
Didn't Mayor Bloomberg want to throw the book at him? I mean, he made like a big statement after this case, right?
Very much so. So I think we'll see about Plaxico. He's also a little bit older guy, and we'll see how much playing days he has left. He's an impact guy that can change a game, but we'll see what happens.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, talking about Brett Favre, Michael Vick, and Michael Phelps. A little Plaxico Burress there. Phelps, of course, losing his record in his polyurethane suit to a German, Mr. Biedermann. Don't ever come here again in your Speedos again, Ibrahim. Thank you very much. Now, some of the news stories we're following. Amy?
There's breaking news this morning. Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who's on his way home from a trip to Iraq, says there's a chance of a modest acceleration, quote, in the pace of U.S. troop withdrawal there. His top generals in Iraq say the security situation on the ground is better than expected. And here back home, the president takes his health care pitch back on the road today. He'll head to two swing states he won last November, North Carolina and Virginia, for more health care town halls. John?
Former Secretary of State Colin Powell, is weighing in on the incident between Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates and a Cambridge police sergeant. Here's what he told CNN's Larry King.
I think he should have reflected on whether or not this was the time to make that big a deal.
Well, who's the he there that he's referring to? Is it Gates
Obama?
Or is it Obama? Powell said he learned as a child, he told Larry King, that you don't argue with a police officer. Overseas again in Iran, some prisoners say they watched detainees being beaten to death by guards in holding pens during Iran's post-election crackdown on opposition figures. The prisoner abuse stories are reported today by our partner, the New York Times. This week, the Iranian government released 140 prisoners and ordered one prison closed. China says it's going to use the death penalty less. That's an official quote from the government. China now executes more people than any other country in the world, at least 1,700 a year. Coming up, Bill Frist joins us, former senator. He's actually still a medical doctor, right?
Indeed.
Your
yes,
former
yes.
boss.
Yep.
Former Senate Majority Leader and heart surgeon. He's going to talk about health care with us. That's coming up in just a minute.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
This is Amy Holmes in All Week with John Hockenberry, and we are joined by my former boss, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
So as you're watching this healthcare debate unfold, do you wish you were still back in the mix in the Senate?
Amy, it is so good to be out of there. No, of course I do. I spent 20 years in medicine and heart and lung transplantation, worked for a socialized system over in England for a year, and did a lot of policy in healthcare there. It's very exciting. Challenges are out there. Needs have been identified, so I'd love to be there. But as you can see, it's like making sausage. Very tough time for our legislators and for the American people.
Well, you have a lot of on your resume. I mean, doctor and senator. Amy, you're a former speechwriter for Senator Frist. I'm wondering if it's tougher to be a speechwriter for you or tougher to be a surgical assistant for you.
Yeah, that's right. You'll have to ask, Amy. You know, well, a lot of people, it is all healing, and it's interesting. Really healing one-on-one to going to the United States Senate, losing your mind and going to the Senate and healing there as well. But it's a great opportunity to have served the American people there.
So let's look at the policy of healthcare that's, you know, been being debated. What's the good in it, and what do you think is the bad?
Well, Amy, first of all, we have huge problems in our healthcare system today, and I say that as one who literally has been on the ground. The biggest challenge, I think, is the cost, and that's what really most people see out there. The fact that their premiums are going up three times faster than wages, it simply can't be sustained. And then the big, really egalitarian challenge out there is that how in the richest country in the world, where most people today do think we have an obligation, I certainly do, and a responsibility to take care of those people who can't take care of themselves, that 20 million hardcore uninsured out there, how do we bring them into the market? And to do all of that, which is the challenge that our legislators have, in a time where our debt is skyrocketing as a country, a doubling of our number of seniors, a challenge where people are going bankrupt in their own lives every day now, how do you add a huge cost, a huge expense to bring those people into the system?
Well, let me quibble with your assumption there at the risk of being a bad host here, Senator. You say that how do we bring them into the market, those 20 million uninsured? Mm-hmm. I mean, in fact, the market kicked them out.
They did.
So it's not a matter of bringing them into the market. I mean, the government explicitly has to do what the market won't do.
I agree.
I don't know if there's a market-based solution here.
I agree. Oh, there is a market-based solution. We got 160 million people out there today who are in private insurance. And if you basically say, let's take that away, put them into, for example, a government plan, what will happen is what I saw in England. It really will be a rationing of care.
All right, government plan, dirty word. Government co-op, dirty
word?
Well,
you know, government plan is not a dirty word. I think what a dirty word is a public plan that is nationalized, that takes away patient choice, that ultimately results in being a system like in England that discourages innovation. That's what's bad. The public plan itself is not bad. So clearly, as a backup, you need to have something outside of the private sector. And that could be local. It could be state-run. It could be a coalition. It could be a cooperative.
So let's get back to the politics of this. It looks like that those Blue Dog Democrats have slowed down the process, and the House and the Senate will not meet this August recess deadline. Why do you think this is happening? How have the politics played out?
You know, I think President Obama really took a misstep here. And even today, he ends up bashing the previous administration, and that's sort of his mantra. It works in a campaign. It probably works for the first couple of months. But what he really should have been doing is uniting the Democrats, people like Jim Cooper from Tennessee, a Blue Dog Democrat. That's a centrist Democrat who basically says, we can't add $1.6 trillion in additional spending today.
Oh, he's on the program later. Actually,
we're talking about it. Well, basically, I think that the President Obama, again, he's the most inspirational politician I've ever met. But at the end of the day, he should have been focusing on those Blue Dog Democrats, bringing them into the room.
Well, let me grab two things that you just said, because I really can't resist. I mean, on the one hand, you're saying we want entrepreneurial sort of innovation in healthcare, not like in England. Mm-hmm. Yet the innovation that happens in American healthcare is focused on end-of-life procedures, expensive procedures. It's not in the preventive aspect, the sort of cost reduction areas that might actually help all of our health. It's much more in the sort of expensive kind of surgical end of medicine.
No,
As a surgeon, why do we take a doctor's advice on reforming health care when so much of the cost of health care is associated with the kind of procedures that you do?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I am a heart and lung transplant surgeon. It's very, very expensive and life-saving. But I also understand the importance of clean water, the number one killer of people in the world today, around the world, public health issues, research on basic things like prevention have to be increased. They're ongoing today. We do emphasize specialized care too much over primary care, and that's one of the good things that President Obama is doing in this legislation, is focusing on primary care, and countries like England and even Canada do a better job than us. It's rebuilding the incentives of the greatest health care, yes, technology, but also, I would argue, basic health care in terms of prevention, in terms of innovation in the world. The problem is it is an inadequate distribution. We're leaving 46 million people out of what 220 million, 230 million people are taking advantage of.
You sure you don't wish you were back?
So you've been talking to some of these members of the Gang of Six, as they're called, three Republican senators, three Democratic senators.
Baucus, Grassley.
And so forth. What compromises do you think need to be made in order for there to be a bipartisan consensus on the Senate side?
Yeah, Amy, I think right now we can't spend $1.6 trillion at a time. Our people listening to us are losing their jobs. Companies are going bankrupt. People are operating on margins. And to say that you're going to have to fork up $1.6 trillion. So you're going to have to squeeze the program down maybe to $500 billion as a first step. President Obama basically wants to cure all of the problems in 6 months. And although he's a great politician, the American people know. They know that you can't do that. You can't.
Healthcare is one-sixth of the economy. It's
that's
the size
of France. 18% of the economy. And maybe that's not even so bad. The problem is growing much faster than any other part of the economy and one growing faster than one wages. President Obama can't keep promising the insurance that he has as a United States senator or had, or that Bill Frist had, to 46 million people, and then basically look at people and say, you're not going to have to pay for it at all. You just can't do that in this day and time.
Well, I got to just – but isn't it worth $1.5 trillion if we actually do get health care reform? I mean, imagine what we've spent on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I think that's what Americans are asking. Let's pay some money for this. This is worth something to me.
But they're not. Right now, the Democrat plan that's on the table – the Waxman plan, the only one that's been written, says that those people making more than $175,000 apiece, a couple making $350,000, are going to have to pay an additional $20,000 tomorrow, soon, in order to cover the 46 million people who have promised a gold-plated Cadillac version of a plan. That simply can't be done in this day and time. I am for 100% coverage, or coverage for 100% of America, affordable coverage. I am Bill Frist, Republican. I think we need to move towards universal care. The problem is we can't do it when this country is going bankrupt, and the American taxpayer and the American family feels that bankruptcy today. Let's phase it in.
Senator Frist, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Senator Frist has a book coming out in October. You can pre-order it at Amazon. It's called A Heart to Serve. Thanks so much.
I feel like I'm in the Senate, actually, listening to that. I feel like I'm one of your colleagues on the other side of the aisle there. That was great. Thank you so
John,
much, Senator.
Thank you very much.
All right, coming up, steak. Even if the economy is rough, it doesn't have to be rough on your stomach. You can get prime meat in places you never thought. That's coming up in 10 minutes.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And Amy, the repercussions from Iran's controversial election continue. I don't know if you heard our colleagues at This American Life over the weekend. They had a fascinating story about the problems in Iran of coerced confessions taking place. Opposition people being forced to confess publicly. That's a huge story inside Iran. Our partners at the New York Times have another huge story, a shocking story of abusive prisoners in Iran's post-election crackdown. Robert Wirth, New York Times bureau chief, joins us from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. He wrote the story. What happened to the people who were arrested after the election is really the focus of your story. Robert, explain.
Well, there's been concern for weeks among the opposition people about what was happening in the prisons. But it all ramped up in the past few days because there were new reports of people who had been tortured and in some cases killed in prison. And especially what happened really with it, to ramp this up, was that a young man with links to the conservative political figures died in prison, according to his father, after being badly beaten. So this got a lot of conservative MPs upset. And then day after day in the past week, there were reports of you know, more and more people who had you know, whose families had been asked to come pick them up. And apparently these are people who had been, they'd been arrested in protests, you know, taken in, arrested, brought into prison, and as far as we know, in decent health, and then somehow died in prison. So the concern just got bigger and bigger, and Mousavi, the main opposition leader, gave a really, really angry speech about it. There was more and more talk in Parliament. And then finally, the government seemed to be feeling a lot of pressure and began to talk about, you know, taking measures, and finally they released a lot of prisoners yesterday.
Well, let's talk about that, the government taking measures. How high do people suspect the orders came to conduct this abuse?
We don't know about that. I mean, people believe that a lot of what was being done by the Revolutionary Guard and elements of the besieged militia. And that's been one concern, even among conservative lawmakers, is that they feel, you know, one of them actually got up and said the other day, you know, it's the intelligence ministry says or tells us, he said, and the police tell us, they don't know where these people are. They don't know what's going on. The law enforcement in Iran,
wow,
like the rest of the government, is complicated with sort of multiple power centers. So there's long been sort of, you know, it's long been known that there were sort of unofficial prisons going on. But I think this just, it's more high visibility now, and there's more concern, again, especially after this young man died whose father was an advisor to a conservative figure.
So, Robert Wirth, the takeaway here is that we're not seeing the reveal of a police state that's in lockstep from top to bottom. We're more seeing the kind of chaos reflected in the prisons and in law enforcement from the grassroots political opposition movement that this entire post-election period has been about.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's not as if there's been some dramatic shift. There's a long-term shift in power, I think, towards the Revolutionary Guards. And many feel that they may have been involved in some way in this election. And so I think there's some concern, again, not just among opposition people, but among people and you know, conservative politicians. And again, it's worth emphasizing that Ahmadinejad, who's a former Revolutionary Guard, has a lot of prominent opponents,
right,
in the conservative movement.
It's interesting. Well, the Revolutionary Guard is certainly the institution to watch in Iran. Robert Wirth, New York Times Beirut bureau chief, with a page one piece on prisoner abuse in post-election Iran. He joined us from Dubai. Thank you, Robert.
It's a pleasure.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm John Hockenberry with Amy Holmes. You might say it's prime time for steaks. That's right. You get prime steaks in places you never thought possible. Coming up, we're going to talk about why expensive cuts are coming down in price. It's an economic indicator. But let's get a check of this morning's headlines. Amy?
John, let's start with Iraq. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says some U.S. troops there could get out early. He says he sees possible, quote, modest acceleration in the pace of troop withdrawals. Gates is wrapping up a visit to Iraq. Microsoft and Yahoo are teaming up. They're launching a search partnership just announced this morning. The primary target is Google, of course, and its command of the online ad market. MS tried to buy Yahoo outright last year, but the company said no.
And if you Google the word fear this morning, it doesn't exist. Actually, I don't think Google is worried at all about this story. An international search on now for survivors in the Caribbean. Dozens of Haitian migrants are missing after a rickety boat sank yesterday. The U.S. Coast Guard is on the scene now. Earlier, we spoke with Lieutenant Commander Matt Morlag.
We are going to be searching this morning. Our aircraft are in the air en route to search area to begin their searches today. Weather is a little choppy in the area.
Some 200 were on board. The good news there is rescuers found more than half, well over half of those people. And that's some of the stories we're following in the news this morning.
Eat steak, eat steak, eat a big old steer. Eat steak, eat steak, do we have one deer? Eat steak, eat steak, eat a mighty good steer.
What you just heard was the sizzling sound of a prime cut of steak. And for you meat lovers, there's a silver stomach lining in this recession. Steak has become less expensive. Sorry, vegetarians.
With the economy downturn and people going out to fine dining restaurants less and less, the meat that would therefore be going to those restaurants is now on the open market for us to purchase.
That's Bob Husky, a meat buyer for Costco. Costco has great steaks, but now they have prime steak. And here to talk about that with us is our guest,
Melissa Clark. It's a Food Wednesday. Melissa Clark, who brought us, bearing gifts. She always bears gifts. We got a little steak here. This is prime steak, Melissa?
That is prime steak, USDA.
From Costco?
From Costco.
Now, everybody knows that Costco gives you great deals, and, you know, it is quality. I mean, quality is part of Costco's brand, but what is the significance of prime meat showing up at Costco? And then let's just find out what cooks can do about that.
Well, this is huge, because USDA-labeled prime meat is only about at most 2% of our entire meat supply out there.
Really?
And it usually only goes to fancy steakhouses. I mean, that's why when you go out and you go to a steakhouse, you can get, you know, a porterhouse for two will cost $50, because it is the creme de la creme. There is no steak better. It has a marbled flesh, which means that when you cut into it, it's got that buttery texture in the mouth. Mm. It kind of melts.
All right, well, let's do some pricing. Let's stick with the economics first.
Yeah.
I know you love to get into the taste buds
thing. I want to talk about steak.
On the restaurant plate, okay, a porterhouse, maybe it's a 2-pound porterhouse, it's going to cost you $34. That's for one, okay?
Right. If you to serve two, usually a porterhouse is for two, it's going to be at least, you know, $45.
Maybe $19 a pound, maybe $18 a pound. At Costco, what kind of prices are we talking
about?
Oh,
we're talking, I was shocked. I mean, I had heard they had good deals, but I didn't realize they had $9.99 a pound.
$9.99.
That is cheaper than regular steak at some markets.
You know, we've already done the story about how in this recession, lobsters have gone plummeted in price.
Right.
$5.99 is a price you can sometimes get for lobsters. So what does it mean to be able to buy prime meat at Costco? Consumers, give us a guide to what you should actually be purchasing.
Well, I mean, what it means for consumers is you're going to get great deals right now, because there's a surplus of steak, basically. Steakhouses aren't doing the kind of business they were doing pre-recession. They don't have the customers. They're not putting in the orders. So all you have all this steak that's just floating around the universe that needs a home, and Costco very graciously is, and other, not just Costco, you can find it in all supermarkets across the country, in very good ones. You just have to ask.
So you could find this in Safeway, Whole Foods.
Maybe Whole Foods. I don't think Safeway, although you may be able to. You should ask. You should definitely go in and start looking at the labels. I think most of us don't even know we can look for prime meat. It's not even part of our supermarket universe, but now it is. So when you go to the supermarket, you have to look at the label and it'll say USDA prime. That means you're going to get this amazing cut of meat that I was talking about. You'll also see cuts that you don't usually see at the supermarket. Hmm. You know, usually you see ribeye or strip steak, but it's hard to find a porterhouse just at your regular supermarket. You have to go to the butcher for that. But you can find porterhouse, you can find whole fillets, you can find filet mignon.
Porterhouse is the one with the big bone.
It's like a T-bone,
filet
right?
Filet mignon is the tenderloin, the sort of interior kind of tender.
Exactly, and that's the most tender cut. Filet, and the porterhouse has a little more chew on it.
So you're a New York Times food writer. Does that mean, like, you can, call up Michael Pollan and say, hey, it's golden days for meat? And he says, sure, I'd love to come over to your house.
We know what
Michael Pollan thinks about the meat.
Well, yeah, I mean, all those problems are still there. I mean, it's not like the steak has changed. It's still the same steak that Michael Pollan is writing about. So if you, it's not grass-fed meat. We're not talking grass-fed meat. We're not talking about sustainably raised meat. We're talking about... But we are talking about very, very tasty meat. So this is your ethical choice here on your plate.
And I've been told that you are, in fact, a junkie of this kind of meat.
Well, I love steak. I love it grass-fed. I love it corn-fed. I just love steak.
You're a woman after my own heart. My dad used to call me his little carnivore.
Oh,
really?
Yeah, that's such a nice... That's so sweet.
Hey, Dad, the little carnivore's doing great on the radio this morning.
Yeah, John, pass over some of that steak.
You'll
get all over there.
You'll notice it's very rare. I only cook steak rare.
No, this is absolutely delicious. Now, explain to me how not to ruin a prime cut.
Right, so you've got your beautiful prime meat that you've got at a bargain price, but you still don't want to mess it up. You still want to make this an amazing dinner. So to make make it steakhouse delicious, you need to get a char on it. That's what sets steakhouse meat apart, is that you know how they can get it really crusty on the outside and then still rare in the middle.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so the trick is use a very hot pan or hot grill.
And start at room temperature,
you
right?
Have
Don't
to start
pull
your meat
it out of the fridge and throw it on the grill.
Right, that's important. Okay, so you've got your meat. You want to try to buy it at least 1 to 1.5 inches thick, okay? The thicker, the better. And then you've got your thick cut of meat. You want to put a lot of salt and pepper on it, more than you'd think. I think most people are very delicate when they salt. Use a big fat pinch per side, one pinch per side, salt, kosher salt, coarse salt, and pepper. Rub that into the meat.
And it's not just about flavor. It's about changing the moisture content
exactly.
and making it better for the grill,
it
right?
makes it, right. What it does is starts to draw out the moisture and also the fat a little bit, and it'll help with the char. So if you don't salt it, you're not going to get as good a char on the meat.
What about the butter? I think at Ruth Chris, they put a whole
yes.
lot of butter on their steak.
Yeah, you don't. You know, you can do the butter, but with prime steak, you don't really need it with prime steak. I mean, I think with lesser cuts, I love to put, have you ever had a compound butter where you take garlic and parsley and you chop it up and you put it in your butter and it turns green? It has
That's
such intense
stuff.
Flavor.
Yeah.
And then you put that on top of your steak. But for a prime piece of meat, you don't need anything but salt and pepper.
Oh, here's a cooking question. What about this idea of letting the meat rest?
Yeah, that's a good idea. But don't do it for too long because your meat could overcook. So, you've got your meat on the grill. You're cooking it. Don't when you put your meat on the grill, first of all, this is important. Don't move it. Don't touch it. A lot of people want to move it here and there. Let it sit for a good few minutes on one side before you flip it, 3 to 4 minutes per side probably, and then let it rest. When you take it off, you want to let it rest for people. Some people say 10 minutes. That's way too long. I'd say about 3 or 4
And what
minutes.
Does that do? It lets it reabsorb
right.
the juice?
And also finishes cooking, because you want to take it off a few degrees before it's cooked. Otherwise, again, it's going to overcook when it sits. So
John,
this is important.
Is this fair to be doing to our listeners at this hour
well,
in the morning?
Well, I don't know. They may not be hungry for steak
we've
yet.
We've done so much worse than this, actually. Apparently, people aren't going to have steak for breakfast, but there is actually a tradition of steak and eggs in the Midwest,
that's very
right?
True.
Maybe not prime steak and eggs.
Well, I mean, now it could be prime steak and eggs. Go to Costco. It's just not that expensive anymore.
Right. Now, does Costco see an opportunity here? I mean, are they getting a big price profit from this?
Yeah. I'm sure they are. I actually did not interview anybody from Costco, but I imagine that they're taking advantage of, in a good way. They're, they see the surplus. I mean, the meat's out there. Somebody's got to eat it. It might as well be us, right?
Okay, so we've already done lobster, on this show.
Right.
We're now doing prime steak, which normally is not available unless you're a restaurant buyer.
Or you would have to mail order it. Have you ever seen those mail order?
Absolutely.
That's prime
Omaha
meat.
Steak.
Right, exactly.
What food will we be doing next
in this
recession, do you think? You've probably got the short list.
I don't have the short list, but if I could. If I could make a suggestion, I would like it to be maybe truffles or caviar, but
right.
But we'll see.
Oh, truffles, caviar, such sophisticated taste. Melissa Clark, takeaway friend, New York Times food writer, talking to us on Food Wednesday here on The Takeaway. Thanks so much for the steak, Melissa.
Steak's not the only thing on our plate, to continue the puns. So is healthcare, and we want your advice. We're asking you, what can Obama do to get it passed, or why do you think it should die? Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Yeah, you're going to talk about healthcare now after we've given everyone a heart
right.
attack and filled their veins with cholesterol and arteries. Okay, here's your takeaway.
We do emphasize specialized care too much over primary care, and that's one of the good things that President Obama is doing in this legislation, is focusing on primary care, and countries like England and even Canada do a better job than us.
After that much talk about steak, we need a heart surgeon. That's Bill Frist, heart surgeon, former Senate Majority Leader, talking there about health care. One more thing. Go to our website where sports correspondent Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen says maybe Michael Vick and Plaxico Burress will fade into memory as one-time greats who let talent slip away and expectations go unfulfilled. I'm rooting for their comeback, says Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. You can weigh in at our website. Go to thetakeaway.org.
I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Huckenberry. You are listening to The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
The president sells health care to golden boys and golden girls.
a toast.
Okay.
To finality and closure.
Closure on healthcare? Doubtful.
We're not going to have a perfect healthcare system. It's a complicated system. There are always going to be some problems out there. But we could be doing a lot better than we're doing right now.
You're just upset because I won't take the first thing they bring out.
You don't take anything they bring out.
I took you.
Thank you for being a friend.
That's right. President Obama is looking for some friends among seniors on health care. Golden Girls and Blue Dogs, they're all uphill battles on health care for the president. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Wednesday, July 29th. I'm John Hockenberry. Amy Holmes is with us all week. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
On the show today, more on the push in the Senate and the House to produce something on health care before Congress breaks. We have all sorts of voices. We'll see what the conversation is like among senior citizens whose health care needs are a big part of the debate. We also check in on that ship that capsized in the Caribbean with 200 Haitians aboard and on efforts to reform public housing in Atlanta.
On the show today, we have Congressman Jim Cooper of Tennessee, one of those blue dogs you were just talking about.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. So, Congressman Cooper, are you one of those Democrats who's creating an uphill battle for the president?
We just want a good bill for every American, a bill that works in every state. And this is probably the most important single thing we'll ever legislate on because it'll have more impact on individuals' lives.
Congressman Cooper, stay with us. We'll continue our conversation in just a few moments.
And first, everything you need to know in the news, in the headlines. As he wraps his trip to Iraq, Defense Secretary Robert Gates says there is a chance of a modest acceleration in the pace of U.S. troop withdrawals from Iraq. His top generals there say the security situation on the ground is better than expected, Amy.
Just out this morning, June orders for big-ticket factory items like aircrafts and autos posted the biggest drop in 5 months. The Commerce Department says orders for durable goods fell 2.5%, with a whopping 38% drop in commercial aircraft orders. The president hits the road again to pitch health care today. He'll head to two swing states he won last November, North Carolina and Virginia. The U.S. Coast Guard says the weather is choppy as the search continues for dozens of Haitian migrants still missing after their handmade sailboat sank in the Caribbean. About 100 people have been rescued so far.
So Microsoft has just announced a deal finally with Yahoo for an internet search partnership. It ends years of back and forth negotiations and is supposed to scare Google, but we'll have to see about that. Well, back in the U.S., Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in California has signed his revised state budget after slashing billions from the plan with his line item veto. State Democrats are criticizing him for cutting social welfare programs. Markets open this hour, mostly flat yesterday. The Dow opens at 9097 today. S&P starts trading at 980, and the NASDAQ begins at 1976. Futures suggest a negative opening on the market, and you were just talking about those big ticket items being down. That's also a suggestion that the market will be negative when it finally opens. We're talking about health care, and we want your advice. What can Obama do to get health care passed, or why should the health care reform initiative fail? What do you think?
I'd like to hear from the viewers and hear what they think.
And how can they get in touch with us?
They can get in touch with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
There you go.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Voices on Healthcare for the first half of this hour of programming. You can actually go to our website and hear another voice, former Senator Bill Frist talking about healthcare. You can podcast the program at thetakeaway.org. We're also going to hear from a group of Blue Dog Democrats who could be the determining factor in whether the legislation goes forward.
And later, John, we're going to be talking to a geriatrician about the fear some have that end-of-life care may be rationed. But first, the debate continues today in both chambers of Congress. Joining us from the front lines is Takeaway's very own Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick. Todd, thank you.
Hi, good morning.
Todd, let's take a look at the Senate side first. What sort of progress is this gang of six making in their daily deliberations?
Okay, by the gang of six, you're referring to a group of three Republicans and three Democrats who've been meeting every day for hours and hours each day to try to hash out the only bipartisan agreement that's on the table in Congress right now. And a little bit of news last night. They've been meeting every day, as I said, for weeks and weeks and weeks. And finally, we got a little bit of news last night. They've agreed in principle. You know, we've been talking about the public option, what kind of public option would be available in health reform. The president says he wants one. Well, the Finance Committee's come up with something a little different. It's called a co-op. We've talked a little bit about it. It is not a public option. It's sort of a hybrid. Here's Senator Kent Conrad. He's chairman of the Budget Committee. He is one of the Gang of Six, and we talked to him yesterday when he came out with a little bit of news.
The latest alternative, the actuaries tell us they believe would attract 12 million people, would make it the third largest provider of health insurance in the country.
That is the most specific we've heard on the co-op. He's saying it would, that the actuaries are telling them it would insure 12 million people. It would cost $6 billion in startup money from the federal government to start. That it would work either on the state level or the national level. That's all the details we got. But it is a little bit of news, and it looks like sort of a way forward for consensus in the Senate.
So, Todd, turning to the House side, President Obama has been pushing for a vote from them by the end of this week. Do you think that's going to happen?
Right. No, it is not going to happen. And everybody has said that except for the speaker herself. The majority leader said it. Everybody else has sort of
alluded
to it.
Charlie Rangel said it.
Yeah, not going to happen. Not going to happen before the break.
So, meanwhile, it looks like then, though, what the House and the Senate are, you know, each separately debating look very different. How do they work this out?
Well, this is a really interesting part about this. We're talking about this co-op plan on the Senate side. And on the House side, you've got a very different dynamic. A huge group of progressives, liberals, who want a strong government-run public option. The one the president has suggested he's for. And the dynamic is very interesting. They have a big group who have said they are not voting for any kind of co-op. It's watered down. It's milquetoast. They want a strong government plan. Listen to Lynn Woolsey. She's one of the leaders of the liberal faction, the Progressive Caucus in the House. Here's what she has to say about the co-op plan that's formulating in the Senate now.
It is absolutely clear that the Progressive Caucus is not going to vote for something in conference that weakens the public option. So the Senate can dance to their own tune. There will be no voting for a bill that doesn't have a robust public option. I mean, we aren't doing this in the House to have the Senate muck it up.
Okay, so you can start to hear how wide the chasm is between big groups in the House and what the Senate thinks it needs to do to get that magical 60 votes. And the real interesting dynamic here is that, you know, we've heard a lot about these conservative blue dog Democrats who are negotiating with the House leadership to get a bill on the House side. Well, traditionally in the House, the blue dogs negotiate their pants off. And at the end of the day, the Senate kind of sends a bill back, and the blue dogs, a lot of people say sometimes they have to roll over and take it. Well, there's sort of the opposite dynamic this time. The blue dogs seem to be in on the negotiations, and you can hear progressives like Lynn Woolsey seem to be a little bit out on the fringes, afraid that their issue is going to get eaten up.
Interesting stuff, yep. Todd, and we actually have a blue dog coming up on the show. That was Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Blue dog Democrat, so-called Jim Cooper, joins us now, Tennessee congressman. We spoke with him there at the top of the hour. He's a congressman. He's one of the so-called blue dog Democrats, but he's been teaching health care policy at Vanderbilt University for 12 years, and so, you know, comes by his authority rightly. Congressman, thanks so much for staying with us here.
Delighted to.
Now, thanks. You know, I'm going to come at you pretty hard right at the top here. There's a Democratic majority in the House, a Democratic majority in the Senate. The Democrats have the White House. It would appear that one might conclude that there's a consensus in America that the Democrats' vision is what should proceed in the government here. And for you and some conservative Democrats to stand in the way of that suggests that you're standing up in the wave of a national consensus. How is that not the case?
I think if you look closer at the issue, you'll discover the Blue Dog Democrats are probably more in agreement with the White House and with President Obama on his three priorities of deficit neutrality, bending the cost curve in the right direction, and a bill that works. We're more in tune with the White House than the House leadership is. So people need to understand that. They also need to understand that regardless of what we want to have in a bill, it's got to get 60 votes in the U.S. Senate. That's the key threshold, because there are plenty of Democratic votes in the House. But how do you get 60 votes in the Senate? That's going to take some form of bipartisanship, whether we want to have that or not. And while Senator Baucus is working on one bipartisan approach, there are others. There's the so-called Healthy Americans Act, the Wyden-Bennett bill, the Eshoo-Emerson bill in the House. which is even much more bipartisan than what Senator Baucus has been working on.
Is there a target for you? Is there a target for you and your colleagues in the House as you look at a version that you could actually vote for? Is it a price tag issue? Is it a co-op issue? Is it a government voluntary hybrid sort of system?
Well, the Congressional Budget Office has tested all the congressional bills so far, and guess what? Every one so far has failed except for the Healthy Americans Act, which is the one they won't allow us to talk about. The president has insisted repeatedly, he did it on primetime television last week, the bill has to be deficit neutral. It has to bend the cost curves in the right direction. And so far, the House bill is bending the cost curve in the wrong direction. So that's the opposite of reform. So it's important to look at the details of this bill. It's 1,000 pages long. We had a five-hour walkthrough just the other night. That was 1 hour for every 200 pages. We still don't feel comfortable with everything that's in the bill. Now, we're working on it. We want the Obama administration to succeed in passing good health care legislation. We can do it on the president's timetable, which is this fall. We're working 18 hours a day to get this done. And I think the key is to realize that Blue Dogs, in many ways, are more in tune with the president's budget priorities than the House leadership.
You said that, but you know, it does appear that Americans do want something to happen. And in an era where we're spending $1 trillion and change on financial reform and bank bailouts and Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, why not pay $1.5 trillion for health care and then worry about reducing the costs later? At least we get the change that we need, some sort of system in place to even begin to deal with some of these problems. Is $1.5 trillion over the top?
Well, listen more closely to the president because he tells you the status quo is not an option. Why is that? Because our current health care programs, the programs we already have and take for granted, vitally important programs like Medicare and Medicaid, guess what? Each one is already over $30 trillion in the hole. So that's the current problem we face. That's why we have to bend the cost curves in the right direction because we have to make our current system affordable, much less before we talk about these new add-ons. I'm for health care reform. I want a good bill to pass. I've been working most of my life on getting this to happen. But it's very important that we get the details right because there's huge inequities between different states. There are huge inequities between the quality of different health care systems. And we can make that work better for everybody if we just get calm about this and do it right.
Congressman, this is Amy Holmes here. I have a little bit different take on this. We've seen that the president's approval ratings are going down and the public's confidence in his handling of health care is going down. Does this give you pause? Does it make you nervous?
It worries me greatly. I'd been pushing for a health care reform right after Inauguration Day because we had our bill ready, completely bipartisan and scored by CBO to save money and bend the cost curve in the right direction. Unfortunately, other decisions were made by House leadership to take up other legislation. I think we missed a precious 6 months of the honeymoon period, but it's not too late right now. We can still get this done. The key is to have an open dialogue with all the American people, not just hardcore Democrats and Republicans, but also the folks in the middle who really are worried and skeptical and want to know more what's in the bill. And we can do that during this August recess.
Congressman, let me get to a point that you just made about you keep talking about House leadership. You hear some Democratic grumbling that the president hasn't weighed in enough, that there's been a lack of leadership from Pennsylvania Avenue to forge this bipartisan consensus. What do you say?
I think we need more adult supervision in Congress. We're a group of 435 people. It's very difficult to organize. And the White House has the bully pulpit, so we welcome their supervision.
Isn't part of the problem, though, with the bill that you say was ready to go during the honeymoon period is that, in fact, the 46 million uninsured Americans, most of them would be out of luck under that bill?
Oh, completely wrong. CBO scored the bill. It's the only bill that would actually cover everybody. And the House leadership bills that they're talking about would leave, depending on your measure, between 17 million to 10 million people out entirely. Our bill would cover everybody. So we've got to get our facts right, and too few people have looked at this thoroughly original, bipartisan, Wyden-Bennett, Healthy Americans Act approach.
All right, to Tennessee Congressman Jim Cooper, teaching health care policy at Vanderbilt for 12 years. He's also one of the Blue Dog Democrats negotiating with the White House, the House leadership, and with Republicans to get a bipartisan health care reform bill. Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I got a letter the other day from a woman. She said, I don't want government-run health care. I don't want socialized medicine. And don't touch my Medicare.
That was, of course, President Barack Obama, who had a town hall yesterday with members of the AARP lobbying difficult questions at him. Well, you know what? We've got our very own town hall meeting here today with Reba Moon and Jean Barrett. Reba owns a small granite supply business with her husband in Alberton, Georgia. Reba, tell us what you're facing.
We're facing high insurance premiums. They've gone up from last year from $528 per month, per person, to $765 this year, per person, per month. And it's just gotten to where we can't pay it. Most small businesses can't afford insurance for their people. And it's gotten to where it's just taking everything we have or what we make to pay major medical insurance.
So when you look at these reform proposals being batted around, what do you think? Is there anything that worries you as a small business owner?
I think there's something's got to be done, and it's got to be done very quickly. There's so many people around that doesn't have insurance, that can't afford insurance, and small businesses can't offer insurance because they can't keep their businesses open because the health care is so high.
But, Reba, just to be clear, if they force you as a mandate to get insurance and to keep insurance, how much of a subsidy do you think you and your business would need to maintain that insurance if it becomes a matter of law?
My goodness, I don't know. I really don't, the way it keeps going up. We may have to shut the doors. It may get to that point.
And wouldn't that mean then that your employees don't have a job, let alone
exactly.
health care insurance? Let's bring Jean Barrett into this conversation. Jean, hello. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. Jean is a 79-year-old retiree from Queens, New York. Jean, what is your health care coverage like?
My health care coverage myself, personally, it's quite good. From my former employer, I received supplemental insurance, which very little cost to me, actually. And I, of course, covered under Medicare. So overall, my insurance situation is pretty good.
So,
however, an awful lot of people that I associate with and are friends with are an entirely different experience. Reba's right. Many employers are either downgrading or canceling health insurance. They can't afford it. And people that work for smaller companies, I used to specialize in small business, they can't afford it. They can't do it. So as a result, a lot of people are uninsured. Many of the uninsured are just people that that work, but are not receiving any insurance from their employer.
So, Jean, this is actually fairly common, that about 80% of Americans are happy with the health insurance they have, but are very, very concerned about the system. What do you think needs to change for the uninsured and to improve health care in America?
What needs to be?
I know it's a big question.
We could go on for hours and hours
and hours.
I think we've got to find a way to, as President Obama put it, get more bang for the buck. We are wasting money. Literally wasting money, paying for costs that need not be paid for, and reimbursing insurance companies some at a rate that is unsustainable. You get that to the point where health care costs are going up, three times the rate of inflation. And all you can see is that this absolutely cannot go on forever. health costs will double every 7 years under the current rate. And health care costs doubling every 7 years, no one can afford it. No one. I wouldn't expect my insurance company to keep my former employer to keep covering me at that kind of a rate.
Important points all. We also have Dr. Leo Cooney on the phone with us. He's a professor of geriatrics at Yale University School of Medicine. You've been listening to all of this, and you've studied how Medicare works. So in listening to our town hall here at The Takeaway, what is your takeaway?
Well, I certainly completely agree with both Reba and Gene. There's a huge problem of the uninsured. We have to solve that problem. And I think when I can read in the paper and read about this, that's the major focus of healthcare reform right now. But I think that getting to Gene's point, I think that's only a part of the problem. And the huge problem, particularly for the elderly, who usually have Medicare, that only covers part of the cost, Gene's supplementary insurance, what sometimes called Medigap, is really necessary, but has gotten very expensive. But the real issue for older people is the lack of integrated care. And what drives that problem is the lack of primary care physicians. I teach in a medical school. I'm somewhat appalled by the fact that no young physicians want to go into primary care, general internal medicine anymore. When I graduated from Yale Medical School in 1969, 60% of the class went into internal medicine. Last year, 16% went to internal medicine. So we need to have a robust system of primary care, general internists, and family practitioners
right.
to care for our older people, and we don't have that right now.
Hold on one second, Dr. Cooney. Gene Barrett, let me grab a takeaway here. Gene Barrett, I understand you're a cancer survivor. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And you're happy with your health care. That's what you told Amy at the top, right? Okay,
yes,
and Reba, you're a healthy employer, correct?
Yes.
And you're unhappy and actually scared to death about health care, correct?
Yes.
Dr. Leo Cooney, is that the problem right there? The sick are more confident about the future than the healthy in America?
No, but you're talking to one sick person and one healthy person. I don't think you can make that generalization at all. I think there are major problems of access to care for older for people, period, in this country. Part of the problem with access for care is the uninsured. The second problem of access for care is the lack of primary care physicians. So, I don't think you can generalize from what two people say. I think most people see major problems with the American healthcare system. I think that President Obama is absolutely correct and that we have to have healthcare reform. The actual details of how it gets worked out is difficult.
Well, at the very least, a very interesting set of contrasts there. The voices from Dr. Cooney, Reba Moon, and Gene Barrett, three voices on healthcare reform in America. Thanks to all three of you. Coming up, watch out, Google. There's a new behemoth on the internet. Microsoft and Yahoo, well, they're not new, but they are joining forces to try and be the web's bigger search engine. We'll learn the details of that deal. That's coming up next.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
So I'd love this job. It's going to be Micro Who or Yahoo Soft.
You seem to have something
details.
Really against this merger,
no,
John.
No, I think I just like playing with the names. Microsoft and Yahoo merging to partner on a new online search engine. The markets aren't necessarily into the deal. The Dow is open and it's ticking down towards 9,000. Futures suggested that the markets would open lower, and indeed they are. And here are some of the other news stories we're following this morning.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who's been touring Iraq, says there's a chance of a modest acceleration in the pace of U.S. troop withdrawal there. His top generals in Iraq say the security situation on the ground is better than expected. Here back home, the president pitches health care today in two swing states he won last November, North Carolina and Virginia. And Ireland's justice minister says his country will resettle two Guantanamo detainees who will be released soon. The men's identities, travel plans, and new residences, though, will be kept a secret.
Over to California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has signed his revised state budget after making billions in cuts with his line item veto. Here's the governor.
This budget is kind of like the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Boy, I can hear the sound effect. Schwarzenegger is facing criticism from state Democrats for cutting social welfare programs. And those are some of the stories that we're following this morning. So the markets are actually responding sort of positively to the detail that was announced this morning, Microsoft and Yahoo getting together. This is The Takeaway. Gentlemen, start your engines, you might say. How's that again? This is actually the sound of a new challenge to internet giant Google in the form of the search engine Bing that's run by Microsoft. But now the company has joined forces with another search engine, Yahoo. Okay, so does this mean, Amy, that the partnership stacks two engines up against Google's one? Doesn't sound like it. We go to Nick Wingfield now for this huge business story. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Nick, does this deal even potentially scare Google?
Well, we haven't heard from Google yet, but there's no question that it's going to significantly create a much more powerful competitor to Google. The combined market share of these two companies in search, Microsoft and Yahoo, will be about 30% instead of 28% for Yahoo and 8% for Microsoft. So advertisers will have a much more compelling alternative to Google, no question.
Part of the story is the numbers, and you just described them there, the traffic that goes to Microsoft, Yahoo versus the traffic that goes to Google, but there's also a design question with the Bing architecture. Can you explain that?
A design question in terms of how the search engines combine in this deal?
Well, how they work, that basically the approach of Google is very, very different from the approach of Bing, and I'm wondering if there's any indication whether Yahoo plus Bing is going to provide a real alternative other than simply another search engine.
Right. Well, I think what these companies want to do is create a more relevant search engine. So you'll go to Yahoo, you'll see a little powered by Bing icon on there or something like that. But the underlying technology, the companies argue, will become more relevant. The reason it'll become more relevant is it'll have more volume. As you have more volume, more people doing searches, they collect more data about what people are clicking on, particularly the ads, and therefore they argue they'll be able to deliver more relevant ads to you. And so we'll see what it's like in practice, but that's part of the argument here.
Nick, this is Amy Holmes here. Now, these are not necessarily fat days for Google. They've been laying people off. Could this new, partnership be a real economic threat to Google?
Well, first of all, it doesn't, it has to clear all sorts of hurdles, regulatory hurdles, mainly. Probably won't happen until next year. I'm not sure that we'll see any kind of, direct response in terms of Google's business, their finances for a while. But, we'll have to see. The thing is that advertisers, I think, do want an alternative to Google out there. And so it's possible they could start shifting some dollars over to these guys. The question is, they combine their market share, they're near 30%, but does it just continue to erode over time? I mean, that's been the story, is that Google has been getting more and more of the search market. So it's not clear that this will stop that, but
right. We'll
see.
And remember when Yahoo was supposedly a media company, 7.1% down in pre-market trading on Yahoo. It seems to me investors suggest there's not much more valuable in Yahoo than the search engine itself, which means it's come down a long way. Nick Wingfield, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, thanks so much for joining us from your old hometown, Seattle.
And we go from San Francisco now to Sudan, to Khartoum, to hear more about a story we've been talking about all morning. It's a remarkable, a disturbing case happening in Africa's largest country. A Sudanese woman has appeared in court on charges of wearing indecent clothing. And John, what was the indecent clothing?
Pants.
Pants. And if she's convicted, she could face up to 40 lashes. It's really shocking. But she did invite the world's media to witness her case and to witness her punishment, which was suspended. We have a BBC reporter who was on the ground there this morning witnessing the whole thing. James, do we have you on the line?
Yeah, absolutely.
James, thank you. So tell us, can you set the scene? What happened this morning?
Well, essentially, more than 100 people gathered to see this case. As you said, Lubna Hussein, the accused, had sent out invitations. She'd printed out invitation cards, and she sent out emails saying, come to my public flogging tomorrow, which certainly grabs your attention when you see that in your email inbox. So there were diplomats, there were human rights activists, there were journalists, Sudanese and international journalists, curious to see what would happen. Now, of course, she hasn't actually been sentenced, found guilty, or anything like that. This was the first day of the trial, and actually it was adjourned on a rather interesting issue, because she works for the United Nations mission in Sudan, and that would have given her some kind of immunity because of a deal between the Sudanese government and the UN. And she said, I don't want this immunity. I want to go on trial because I think I'm innocent of what you're accusing me of wearing indecent clothing, and I want to prove that in court. So the trial was adjourned to allow Ms. Hussein to resign from the United Nations, to quit her well-paid job so that she can go to court and face a potential punishment of 40 lashes and up to an unlimited fine. So she's clearly very, very convinced that she's innocent. And certainly the women who came out in mass to support her, and I know she was wearing trousers to the court, the gear for which she was apparently in trouble, or pants, as you'd say in America, in trouble for wearing. So this was well-received by her supporters, but clearly still don't know what's going to happen to her.
So, James, does it seem that her strategy of bringing international attention to this case, that it's working, and that the Sudanese government backed down this morning, that they didn't want to put on this public spectacle and, you know, inflame public opinion?
Yeah, I think there's certainly there'll be a strong suspicion that, you know, that is the case, that this could be embarrassing for Sudan if a rather high-profile former journalist, someone who works for the UN, is given 40 lashes. Now, of course, the trial resumes on Tuesday. It's possible that she could be found guilty and given this punishment, although certainly people here suspect that that may not be the case, because it would be embarrassing for Sudan. Sudanese authorities, of course, say their judicial system is independent and can make up its own mind on the merits of the case, though not everybody would believe that.
James, thank you so much for giving us this report. I'm sure we will want to come back for an update next week. That was James Copnell, BBC Sudan correspondent.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Hockenberry. We go now to Campbell Robertson, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. He's near Willow Spring, North Carolina, which in general is known more for its rural southern cuisine and fireflies than it is for being a center of a terrorist sleeper cell. But that's the story this morning. Campbell Robertson, can you explain, first of all, the details of a story that broke yesterday?
Well, basically, there was seven guys here, all from Carolina, who were arrested by the feds on Monday for basically stockpiling weapons and having conversations about engaging in sort of violent jihadist movements and even taking several trips to the Middle East and Kosovo with the idea, the feds say, to sort of participate, though it doesn't seem they've done anything or were near to doing anything. But it was, I guess, getting close enough, and they were stockpiling enough automatic weapons that the feds were getting a little bit nervous about the whole thing and decided to go in.
Now, there's a reaction, because the center of this alleged conspiracy is a 39-year-old drywall installer named Daniel Boyd, who has some experience in Afghanistan. But what are you hearing from local residents who are reacting to both the indictment and the details that are emerging over the history of all these characters with some alarm, I suspect?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you always hear the sort of cliche, you know, it couldn't happen to a nicer family, I never saw it coming. But, I mean, the neighbors are even more adamant than one would expect, that these are, you know, super nice guys. They got a Bronco in the driveway with an American flag sticker on the back. It's, you know, so-and-so, you know, a guy I was talking to yesterday said, well, they have my wheelbarrow. We loaned it to them last week. I mean, it's a very neighborly kind of Mayberry thing. So they sort of run the gamut from shock to absolute, you know, adamant disbelief in the whole thing.
Although, Campbell Robertson, it's not as though Muslims can't have flags on their pickup trucks and borrow wheelbarrows, right? What's different about these people?
It's not the fact that they're Muslims, but I don't know about people plotting violent jihad having flags on the back of their pickup trucks.
Well,
I mean, that's the issue. Everybody in town said it, you know, or everybody I talked to said that the fact that they were Muslim never, I mean, very, very rarely was brought up, though they were clearly very devout.
Although the wife of Daniel Boyd has spoken to the media, what are the details that are emerging from that conversation?
She gave an interview to the Raleigh News and Observer and said that she adamantly denied all the charges, gave some fairly harrowing details on her own side about the actual the day of the raids. You know, and simply said, you know, they're good Americans. They were taking trips to sort of get involved in Arabic culture, and that they had no plans whatsoever of doing anything violent.
So we asked this question already this morning, but I want to put it to you. What does this look like? Are these Boy Scouts with an Islamic tinge there in rural North Carolina? Or is this a real threat, homegrown, passionate, sort of anti-American terrorists?
Well, I mean, the anti-American thing doesn't seem to necessarily be even the charge. I mean, the scary thing I think the feds were saying is these guys had a lot of automatic weapons. They had past history as foreign fighters, and they were having conversations that led the feds to believe that they were going to do something. Now, whether that adds up to anything, you know, it's not my place to say.
Right. Well, at the timing of this arrest, we'll see if that has an impact on the case, whether they actually had enough evidence or if they were fearful that something was going to happen and that motivated the arrest. But we'll learn those details. Campbell Robertson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Campbell Robertson is a reporter for our partner, The New York Times, and he's near Willow Spring, North Carolina, where the arrest of seven alleged terrorists took place on Monday.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Amy Holmes here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, Atlanta is knocking down the last of its high-rise housing projects, and other cities are following suit. So what's happening to the residents? We'll find out, but first, a check of the morning headlines. John?
And we begin with Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who says some American troops may be able to go home from Iraq early. He's wrapping up a trip there. About 5,000 troops could leave early because Gates says the situation there is, quote, better than expected. Microsoft and Yahoo are teaming up and going after Google's online ad revenue. MS and Yahoo are launching a search partnership just announced this morning, and it's moving the markets. Amy?
Big new economic data is out, or should we say bad new economic data. Durable goods orders or big-ticket manufactured items are down 2.5%, and that's much worse than forecasters expected. President Obama hits the road today. He'll pitch his health care agenda to town hall meetings in North Carolina and Virginia.
There are stories of prison abuse in Iran on the New York Times, and China says it's going to cut down on executions. 1,700 people had executed last year, most in the world. We're following all these stories and more this morning.
In 1936, Atlanta, Georgia built the nation's first housing project. But soon, the last of Atlanta's public housing projects may be coming down. That's the sound of Atlanta tearing down one of its last housing projects this June. Atlanta will soon become the first major American city that's project-free.
Well, Atlanta may be the furthest along, but it's not alone in its moves to demolish large projects. Chicago, Detroit, Miami, Las Vegas, and New Orleans have similar plans to tear down large public housing complexes, or already have, and resettle residents in single-family homes dispersed across the city, more like real neighborhoods. The goal is to decentralize poverty. But does it work? The House Subcommittee on Housing and Community Opportunity is holding hearings today on the future of public housing, so we're doing some of the same here on The Takeaway. Joining us is Renee Glover, President and CEO of the Atlanta Housing Authority. I guess we could say you're kind of swinging the wrecking ball there, Renee, right?
Well, that's one way to put it. Good morning.
Good morning. And also with us is California Democratic Congresswoman Maxine Waters. She's the chairwoman of the House Subcommittee on Housing and Community Opportunity. And is it fair to say that you're a little skeptical of the demolition project, Maxine Waters?
I think that's fair. I have to be concerned about public housing policy all over the country, recognizing that there are concentrations of poverty in public housing, recognizing that many of the cities have difficulty in managing these concentrations, and have to figure out what to do to provide decent housing and assistance to the resident.
Right.
I'm not sure that raising them or demolishing them is the answer. I have to be concerned about what happens to them.
Right.
I have to be concerned about the loss of units for poor people. I have to be concerned about the growing number of homelessness.
Well, let's put that. Let's put that.
Find out what this means.
All right, Congresswoman Maxine Waters. Let's put that to Renee Lewis Glover. I sort of mentioned that you were swinging the wrecking ball, but that's perhaps not so fair. I grew up in Chicago, where there were Robert Taylor homes, Cabrini Green, large-scale projects that were a real social problem in that city. Is that really part of the motivation of what you're doing down in Atlanta?
Well, that's absolutely the motivation. And when you look at the conditions of the communities, and particularly the concentrated poverty that the Congresswoman talked about, what you see are all of the externalities of crime, drug trade, and really, the predators of the larger society prey primarily on women with children and the elderly and disabled. And so we have been working very closely to get families integrated into the mainstream. And we've also been supporting the families with coaching and counseling so that they can be successful in mainstream America.
Renee, this is Amy Holmes here. Now, the picture of crime, though, is a little bit more complicated. Hannah Rosen, writing for the Atlantic Monthly last summer, she found that after folks left the housing projects, crime followed them out to the suburbs, so it didn't exactly solve the crime problem. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, I think that that article was an overstatement of an issue. The fact of the matter is we've done some research in Atlanta, and the crime is absolutely not following families. And the question really is, are we reconcentrating families, or are we being thoughtful, again, supporting them with coaching and counseling and helping them make good choices? And I will tell you that if you apply the right strategies, families can make great choices, and they're looking for location near school, location near jobs, and locations where they can be safer because, quite frankly, living in the conditions they were in, they were not looking to replicate that environment. And so we have no evidence at all that crime has gone up as a result of them relocating.
But Congresswoman Maxine Waters, as you look at this as a policy matter, Renee Lewis Glover is talking about incentives and counseling to get people into neighborhoods. Can the market really respond when you reduce the amount of housing available in centralized projects, even if they do constitute real crime centers in big cities like Atlanta?
I don't think so, and that's one of the things we need to find out about. What we find is there are not enough housing units that are available in so-called scattered sites. We're also finding that there is a pushback on communities outside of the housing project area about concentration of Section 8 vouchers. One of the things that I just encountered in a recent hearing was an attempt and an amendment to try and keep us from extending more Section 8 vouchers to a certain section of the greater Los Angeles area. That's why it's so important to know exactly what you're doing. I've always maintained that the housing development should have been treated like little cities with all of the services available inside those complexes so that they would not continue to be places that had problems that were unattended to, like the crime. What I found was in most of the big public housing developments, they didn't have services. They didn't have counseling. They didn't have tutoring. They didn't have the kind of programs to make them more livable. I understand, and I'm not so sure, that we should have the concentrations. But I do know this. We don't have the units outside of that footprint. And so we have to find out what is being done to replace them. I've been in Atlanta, and some of those new developments look very good. But also, I was shocked when I was downtown near that Five Points area in Woodruff Park, where concentrations of homelessness seem to be.
Let's get a comment from Renee. Yeah. We're almost at the end of the hour. Let's get a comment from Renee Lewis Glover on that.
Well, I do want to say that the good news is that all real estate is local. And so it may well be that there's a shortage in Los Angeles, but in Atlanta, particularly now with the economy being on a downturn, we have had no trouble whatsoever in finding not marginal situations, but great situations, because there is softness in the real estate market. And so we're actually ahead of schedule by some 3 months with the last round of relocation.
Well, it's a case where the recession is actually helping, and it's a great debate. We're going to adjourn this hearing on the takeaway because it's the end of the hour. But Renee Glover, thank you. President and CEO of the Atlanta Housing Authority spoke with us from Atlanta. Congresswoman Maxine Waters, Democrat from California's 35th Congressional District, will be holding hearings on this subject officially in Washington. She's the chairwoman of the House Subcommittee on Housing and Community Opportunity. And the issue doesn't stop there. I mean, during this interview, we got an interesting message from one of you.
My name is Carolyn. I'm calling from Atlanta. In Georgia, there is no rent control law, and it is a problem with people being forced out of their home, and it's difficult to find a place with the low income where you can get housing for you and your children.
Certainly an issue that will come up at Maxine Waters' hearings later today. You can give your take to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And all day today, we're also talking health care. We want your advice. We're asking you, what needs to get done to get it passed, or why do you think it should fail?
I think that the president has to emphasize that this health care reform is an investment in our people, so we can have people be healthy and go to work and be more productive.
Weigh in along with other listeners at our website, thetakeaway.org.
And we're going to leave you with a final comment from one Blue Dog Democrat.
I'm for health care reform. I want a good bill to pass. I've been working most of my life on getting this to happen. But it's very important that we get the details right, because there's huge inequities between the quality of different health care systems. And we can make that work better for everybody if we just get calm about this and do it right.
There's a takeaway. That's Tennessee Congressman Jim Cooper. Get calm, do it right.
Stay mellow. I'm Amy Holmes.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.